If you're a fan of the CSI shows, you'll certainly recognize the song by The Who Are You? In fact, it's the theme song, the opening theme song for CSI Vegas. They ask, who are you? And of course, that's the whole premise of investigation and collecting forensic evidence. Who's the person who did it? Welcome to my new podcast dealing with the reality of crime scene investigation. My name is Brian Ward, and I'm a retired staff sergeant from the Toronto Police Service in Canada. My service included 20 years with the Forensic Identification Service, and believe me, I have seen it all. This series of podcasts covers all aspects of forensic investigation of crime scenes and will appeal to both fans of law enforcement as well as mystery writers who need all the facts to do their stories and their novels accurately. I also hope to include examples of different types of crimes in which I have been involved. So let's begin with investigations and how they are defined. Investigations is a problem-solving process intended to solve a specific law enforcement problem by answering six base questions. Did an offense occur? If so, what specific offense was committed? Where did the offense happen? When did it happen? Exactly how did it happen? And of course, most importantly, who committed the offense? In order to answer the first question, did an offense occur, you have to investigate the actual scene of where a suspected crime has taken place. And you have to know your law. You have to know, was this particular offense an offense against the statute law of the area that you live in? For example, in Canada, we have one criminal code that covers criminal offenses across our country. While in the United States and other jurisdictions, each state has its own separate criminal code of conduct. So, as I said, you have to be a pretty astute observer of the laws of your country. Now, the other question that needs to be asked is, where did the offense occur? And I can always recall an instance where a body was found in a field and was found by someone who allegedly was walking through the field and found this person lying there, obviously dead. So officers responded to the scene, cordoned off, and a coroner was called to the scene, pronounced the person dead, and ordered an autopsy, a post-mortem examination of the body. So the body went back to the coroner's office, and an autopsy was commenced. And during the autopsy, the pathologist, the medical examiner, found water in the lungs. Now, this is kind of peculiar because the body was found on dry land. So the pathologist examined under the microscope a sample of the water he found in the lungs. Now, there's little organisms called diatoms, and they're present in lake, stream, river, ocean water, and they're particular to a certain area. So this pathologist was able to identify this little critter, this diatom, which is an algae, to a body of water which is 20 miles away from the scene where the body was found. So obviously something stinky was going on, and that gave the officers enough ammunition to come back, question the person who found the body, and it was revealed that, in fact, yes, he had punched the victim and held his head underwater at a stream about 40 miles away, and then decided to take his body back to a vacant field and just dump him, thinking that he could get away with it. We also have to ask, when did the offense happen? Now, most of the time, investigations are pretty fresh. Sometimes the bodies are decomposed, and a good medical examiner can tell you about the decomposition of the body and how long they may have been dead. We'll talk about that later in some of our other podcasts. But there's also things like maggots. Maggots are Mother Nature's little detectives. They're eggs of the blowfly. What happens when a person has died? The flies will sniff them out, and they'll lay their eggs on the body. And then the eggs take a certain period of time to hatch, and they hatch as little white worms. Now, as gross as it sounds, these little white worms are a terrific asset for investigators to determine how long the body has been dead. There's a field of science called entomology, and entomology is the study of bugs. And there are certain people who specialize in forensic entomology, and they're the people who are able to determine the age of these larvae. So they can tell you that from egg to hatch, it could have taken 2, 3, 4 days or whatever. And of course, that gives you a pretty good indication, especially if someone has an alibi that says, oh yeah, I just saw the guy alive 2 days ago, when in fact your little maggots are telling you that this guy has been dead for 2, 3, 4, 5 days. So the other question has to be asked is, how did the offense happen? How indeed? Pretty easy with a gunshot or a knife, but I can recall a homicide I was involved in where the body of a woman was found in the bedroom of the apartment she shared with her boyfriend. Now, her boyfriend's first name was Jeff, and Jeff came home and found her body. She was fully clothed, lying face down on the bed. There'd been no indication of trauma, no indication of sexual assault or anything else. But we took her back to the coroner's office and we performed a post-mortem examination on her body. Now, the pathologist was able to determine that she had in fact been suffocated. And looking at the evidence on the body, he found two bruises on her shoulder blades. So what had happened is the killer had forced the woman onto the bed face down and then put both his knees on her back, pulled the pillow up over her face, and suffocated her. Now, the bruises appeared after death, and they were a pretty good indication that he had put all his weight on her. If we didn't have that type of evidence, we wouldn't have any kind of a case at all. Interestingly enough, when we got into the apartment, there was a big mirror in the living room, and written on the mirror was a note in lipstick, and the note said, Jeff, J-E-F-F, Y-O-U-R, next. So, of course, what that did immediately is tell us that the person who wrote the note wasn't that well-educated, because he would have written Y-O-U-R-E. So the homicide squad investigated, discovered that the actual killer was someone who had worked with this woman at a car dealership, lusted after her, and figured that if he couldn't have her, nobody else could. The last of the problems an investigator, especially a forensic investigator, has to solve is who committed the offense. Now, we'll be talking in this series of lectures about fingerprints, trace evidence, DNA, any kind of items that were left behind by the bad guy. In the early part of the 20th century, a French doctor and a lawyer named Edmond Locard. Locard theorized his exchange theory. In other words, someone going into a crime scene or anywhere would bring a piece of themselves, whether it's DNA, a head hair, blood drop, fingerprints, you name it. But they would also take a piece of evidence from the scene. So if somebody broke a window to break into a house, chances are there'd be pieces of broken glass in their clothing. So in other words, they broke the window to get in and probably cut themselves, leaving trace evidence behind in the form of blood, and then leaving with glass in their clothing, which is a form of trace evidence coming from the premises. Let's start from the very beginning of the reporting of a crime. So the call goes to the police, and let's say it's a person who's been badly injured in a fight. So the dispatcher radios the police car, dispatches an officer to go over to the scene. He arrives and he finds a body on the ground. Now, this is very important. Is the person dead or not? And I always, always told my students, never presume death, because that person could be alive. You think they look dead, and you just leave them there. Get an ambulance. Get them away from the scene. So once that's been done, you'll find that other officers will start arriving at the scene. And so they will park, and they will get out, and they will talk to potential witnesses. Let's say the incident took place in a bar. Remember our bar fight about the guy who got charged with manslaughter? Well, direct other officers to go in and talk to witnesses to see what they saw, and split them up. And as the first officer in the scene, you also have to communicate with the rest of the team. You have to get detectives there to take a look at the scene and find out what happened. You also have to get your forensics team involved, because they're going to want to fingerprint process the whole bar scene to see what happened, who was there. And you also have to call your boss. Now, your boss could be a staff sergeant or a lieutenant back at the station, whoever is running your shift, but you always have to communicate to them as well. So there's an old management adage that communication goes four ways. It goes up, it goes down, it goes to the left, and it goes to the right. So when you're communicating up, obviously it's the boss, and when you're communicating down, it's going to be the rest of the people on your shift who are going to help you do the preliminary investigation. Once you've gotten things under control, then you have to make a wide, wide crime scene. That's where you see the yellow barricade tape, and we'll talk about that later in other lessons. And there's some pretty strange reactions to the yellow barricade tape. But you have to protect the scene. There have been a number of cases thrown out of court because officers failed to get a search warrant. So let's take the case of a sex crime. A woman was assaulted in her own apartment, and the perpetrator left, and he was arrested soon thereafter. So the officers have to get in, and they have to process the apartment as a crime scene. So you go waltzing through the door, and all of a sudden, your victim, who doesn't want to get involved in any of this, tells you to get out. Can she do that? Yes, she can, because it's her apartment, and she has every right to tell you to leave. So the best method that we always use is to hold off on the investigation and get a warrant to search. Even if she says, yes, fine, go ahead and search, at any time during your search, she may change her mind and say, no, stop. And there's all kinds of physical evidence around about the crime scene, but she's so upset that she just tells you to stop. So the best thing to do is to get a search warrant. Even a stolen car. If you have a stolen car and there could be a gun or there could be drugs inside, stop, get a search warrant, and then go back and search the car. There's a famous case in Western Canada where the Royal Canadian Mounted Police were following a car out on the prairies, and they stopped the car. They just kind of had a feeling about it. They no other reason than just a funny feeling. So they stopped the car, and they made the driver of the car open his trunk. And here was a huge stash of marijuana being transported from one part of Canada to the other. Great, great publicity. Everybody loved the job the guys did. And when it came to court, the judge threw it out. The reason the judge threw it out is because the Mounties had no right to go into the car on just merely suspicion. They had to get a search warrant and prove to a judge or a justice that, in fact, they had grounds to believe that there were drugs being kept or had in that car. Same thing with guns. If you suspect somebody's driving around and may have a gun in the car and you want to preserve it for physical evidence for your investigation, stop it and get a search warrant for it, because you'll sure shoot and lose the evidence if you don't get a search warrant. There is, however, one form of search that can be done without the use of a search warrant. And you as an investigator, especially a forensic investigator, have to be aware of exigent circumstances. This means if someone is in a house and you believe that they're armed and dangerous, or they're shooting out at the police, or there's a crime going on inside, you hear screaming and yelling, and in fact you can break through the door and go inside and arrest the person committing the offense. But the problem here lies with our enthusiasm. We're so enthusiastic about collecting evidence. Once we're inside, oh, look, there's a gun. Let's grab this. Let's grab a box of shells. Let's grab the knife, or let's grab a hammer. Well, you can't do that, because if you do, you'll lose the right to produce it in court. So once the situation is in hand and you need to go through the house, get a search warrant. Another one of the members of your team can go out and get it, but at least you can properly search the home and you won't have any of your evidence out. So that's pretty well it for the introduction. And the next time I'm going to be talking about the science of fingerprints. Fascinating stuff, and it sent more bad guys to jail than anybody else. So we'll see you the next time.